Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is the CEO of Nomad Health and internal medicine physician, Dr. Alexey Nazem. We have a very exciting guest today. He's an internist, a professor at Weill Cornell, and the co-founder and CEO of Nomad Health, a disruptive startup that's had a central role in solving critical healthcare staffing needs, especially during this pandemic. Dr. Alexey Nazem, thank you for joining me. It's a real treat to have you.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here. I love listening to the podcast, and it's fun to now be on it.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Well, before I start, actually, a full disclosure, Nomad is a Polaris portfolio company, and I'm biased because I think Alexey is one of the preeminent physician leaders out there. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go easy on you, Alexey. I actually have a lot of questions about your leadership I'm looking forward to asking. But before I do, like we usually do on this podcast, I want to go a bit into your background, something a little bit more introspective. And it's actually very interesting because we have very similar backgrounds. We were connecting on this before the call too. You and I were both Yalies. You're a real Yalie through and through. You were there for college and medical school. We were both in the same residential college, both with Master Kane, Dean Flick at Silliman. You went to HBS in the middle of medical school, as did I. And then you pursued IM residency like I did, but at Brigham instead of Stanford. The question I want to start with was a question I also was confronted with, which is when you went to do business school, what was the reason you ended up pursuing business school? Why HBS and why not do Yale's 5-year MD-MBA program?
Mm-hmm. Those are all good questions. And thank you very much for the kind introduction. I'm sure you're on your own pathway to do multiple more interesting and important things than I've ever done. So with respect to the question about business school, I actually came to the conclusion that I wanted to do a joint training in medicine and in business before I did either. It was actually while I was still in college as a Yalie. I recall this moment. This was in the early 2000s. It was right after the Human Genome Project had been more or less completed. The first full sequencing of the human genome had been completed. And at the same time, we were just coming off the highs of the dot-com boom and more importantly, just the rise of the idea of the internet and computers. And so there was this seeming convergence between computing power, biotechnology advances, and generally this feeling of being on the precipice of a new era of medicine. And so I got really excited about the intersection between the science and the business. And then I realized, listen, I want to both be in the applied part of this. This is probably going to be the most important thing happening for the next 50 years at the time, 20 years ago. So we still have 30 years to go. But at the time, it felt like we're on the precipice of 50 years of major change, and I want to be able to be right at the rock face. And it felt like in order to do that, you needed to be able to speak both languages, both being the physician, the scientist, understanding what it means to care for patients and to deliver care, understanding the science behind it, and then also recognizing full well that medicine is a business, especially in the United States. And beyond it being a business from a financial perspective, it's just a majorly complex organization. Yeah. And so understanding how to navigate organizations, build organizations seemed very important. So from the very beginning, my intention was to be able to speak both languages, as I said, and to operate in both fields, kind of straddle that line and be an ambassador between both. At that time, and now it feels almost kind of ancient, this point of view, but at that time, they were truly separate worlds. And I remember when I was applying to medical school, I couldn't say to anybody that I was interested in doing business school.
That's right.
Because, you know, no medical school wanted anyone who wanted to have anything to do with business. So obviously that has changed a lot over time. But in any case, I just really thought that I wanted to be able to navigate smoothly in both. And to your last question, you know, well, why specifically Harvard Business School? I think so much about the value of business school is the milieu in which you do it. The skills are extremely important. Right. You can learn those skills in a lot of places, but there's a few places where the network of the students that you're around, but also all of the alumni and the places of impact that they operate, where there's only a few places, a few universities where that is truly, paradigmatically different. And Harvard Business School is one of them. The other thing that I liked about Harvard Business School is that it was in Boston, which is in the middle of a medical mecca. Right. So I knew that while I was in school, I wanted to be able to engage with all the major health systems, research universities, and also the startups that were in that space. So it was a great geography, a great university community, and of course the education itself is just fantastic. One of the things that was very appealing to me was the case method of the Socratic style of teaching in HBS. So anyway, I could go wax on and on and on about it, but. That's why business school and why HBS specifically.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that'll be really valuable. A lot of people listen to this podcast are trainees who confront this exact question. I actually just got an email from one yesterday who was like, I'd love to go more further into like that early part because he was a medical student because it found it very pertinent. And it's actually funny. I had the same exact pathway in terms of wanting to do business school and medical school before I had started either while I was still a college student. And one of the things I was curious about was, did you have any business training or exposure to that world while you were in college? Because I feel like we get a good amount of exposure to medicine when we're pre-med. Mm-hmm. But I feel like sometimes people do that, but I was curious if you ever had that exposure or you had that inkling as something that you had an abstract concept about, but where, you know, hadn't really dipped your toe in yet.
Yeah, no, I absolutely did. And so in college and then after, I didn't have formal business engagement. I didn't work in a company or anything like that. But what I in college, where you're not working in any company or anything, I was very actively involved in this organization called YES, which is called the Yale Entrepreneurial Society. It was started the year that I joined, I started college. So I was very active in, I wasn't one of the founders of the group, but I was right there with all of them and, you know, coming up with all the, you know, events and activities and speakers and, you know, supporting, you know, the business plan competition and the innovation summit and all that kind of stuff. And it was a really, really interesting. Again, like I said, it was in the middle of the dot-com era, pre-crash. And so it was like this fervor around doing startup companies, not just technology companies, just like startup companies. And though much of the economic case for a lot of those dot-coms didn't pan out, what did really sit with me, and that it was something that I had already had as a young kid. I had the great fortune of growing up with my dad, who was an early venture capitalist. I loved the impact. I was so attuned to the impact of creative destruction, where small, nimble companies could come from the outside and completely transform an industry by having a different point of view, a new technology, whatever the case may be. So, you know, the sort of the Davids going after the Goliaths. And I was always attracted to that. And my interest in it only grew by being part of the, that entrepreneurial group in college, where it was just like kind of a thing that you constantly, were constantly drinking in and seeing like, wow, you get a real impact. People were taking on these really challenging things. And, there was sort of like a, what do you call it? It's almost like a, I don't know how to describe it other than saying, like, you don't know enough to know that you shouldn't be trying to do those things. And that's one of the most beautiful things about startups.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it makes sense. And I'm so glad you went on to pursue that passion and build Nomad, which we'll talk about in a moment. It's funny. When I was at Yale, Yale Entrepreneur Society was just being gobbled up by Yale Entrepreneurial Institute, where they were taking all that work and really formalizing it within Yale. And a lot of my friends who ended up in medicine, but also at those events, went on to be VCs or start companies, or some of them didn't do medical school actually too, but were pre-med. It's just interesting to see how that energy and passion can transform into something really impactful if you just stick with it. So,
I think that's the power of college, especially, but also very importantly, the power of in-person collaboration and learning at that early formative stage of your life. I mean, this is not unique to Yale. I mean, Yale is a wonderful environment.
Sure.
I've benefited so much from it. You're sitting now in Stanford, you know, that's another incredible environment for entrepreneurship. But like this idea that you can find your tribe and learn not only skills, but develop passion for something is such a wonderful part of being a youthful, vigorous, malleable person. And, you kind of find your way to the things that are attractive to you. And for me, it was entrepreneurship and science. Those were the things that really drew me. But other things draw other people. I mean, I'm not here to, extol the virtues of education, but certainly that period of a few years was extremely important to my own development and putting me on the trajectory that I'm on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to fast forward a little bit then to now you've done business school, or maybe you're still in business school and you're considering doing residency, or maybe you knew you were going to do residency. How did you think about how you were going to ultimately then use your MBA and clinical practice? Did you have a vision before you had started your residency training? And did you grapple with the concept of doing residency, or did you always want to practice medicine?
Those are good questions. And I think the sort of existential set of questions that everyone in this sort of position always asks, asked of themselves. And so I did ask myself all those questions. So kind of harking back to why I wanted to get into this in the first place, I wanted to be able to speak both languages. Well, I was like a beginner level parlance in medicine and business by the time I finished business school and medical school. Those are merely the primers. You don't really know how to do business or how to practice medicine by going to school. You actually have to go do it. You have to live it. And the amount of learning that I did about what it means to practice medicine, how does the US healthcare system work, any number of different things that that I leverage now on a regular basis, I learned those by being a practicing clinician, of being a resident, and then following later being an attending physician. That is an unsubstitutable experience, that apprenticeship and residency, and then the experience of just being out there on your own, in the context of a team, but the one who is ultimately responsible doctor, at least for your guilt. And, the same thing can be said for doing business. I learned a lot. I mean, one of the things I did like about the case method is that it forces you to, put yourself in the shoes of the decision maker in the particular situation that you're dealing with in the case, but still it's only a simulation. It's not really what it's like to, put yourself in the position to actually make the decision and live with the consequences. So I knew that I wanted to do both of those things. And the most unfiltered, most direct, high octane way of doing both of those things was going to be a resident and practicing as a physician and working as a startup entrepreneur. Both of those things were the most pure forms, I thought, and also the most impactful ways to work on the problems that I was interested in. And then, separately, I mean, there's plenty of other ways to do it. I mean, I worked in some of the policy realm and the hospital administration and things like that, but it just never, it wasn't appealing to me personally. I'm much more of a, I like to like tinker and build. Yeah. And so I'm more of that vein. And so I was very much more attracted to the sort of like high risk building creative environment of a startup.
Did you do any of that while you were a resident or finishing up medical school, or did you just focus on residency when you were a resident at Brigham? Were there options? Because I feel like Brigham has had created and fostered a really incredible environment for people who do want to pursue those interesting things, or I've seen, but it's a lot of work being a resident too.
Yeah. Well, so the short answer to this question is I did as much as I could. I mean, being a resident is a very full-time, more than a full-time job, as you are very well aware. but, you know, to their credit, the leadership at the Brigham, the residency leadership, you know, originally, you know, 30, 40 years ago with Marshall Wolf, and then following on with Joel Katz, this is the Department of Medicine and the internal medicine residency program. They have always fostered this idea of Dr. Plus, the idea of there are many ways to achieve the goal of a physician, which is to care for your fellow man. And so to their credit, they were very, they individually and then the program as a whole created opportunities, or at least was flexible enough to allow you to pursue opportunities that were not right down the fairway, you know, like, you know, doing your heart failure rotation. And so I did get to do some things with, and again, it was in Boston, so it was a, you know, vibrant startup community, and was able to engage with a few companies, and I thank them for those opportunities. But again, it's not the same thing as being 100% into, you know, running a startup, but it was actually extremely informative for me to understand what I liked, what I didn't like, what I was good at, what I wasn't good at, where I could add value, where I couldn't add value. And so it was an important
thing for me to try to weave. Would you recommend that for residents who might be interested in exploring some of these alternative paths to Absolutely. Try doing something like that?
Yeah.
Any framework for how to think about how to do that or approach that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would generalize the prescription to be more, try to do, if you want to do something else, something other than just pure clinical practice, trying that other thing or the variety of other things to figure out what other thing you might be interested in, until such time as you've tried some of those things out, you will never know if they are a fit for you and if you are a fit for it. And so much in the same way that you have to be a resident to really understand what it's like to be a practicing physician, you kind of need to do that apprenticeship in the business or in the other world, whatever it may be, whether it's business, policy, administration, whatever the case may be. So I highly recommend that. The other thing that's really important about that is not only the skill development, but the network development. So one of the things that was very valuable for me was that I was just kind of putting that juju out in the universe that Alexi is a person who's interested in this kind of stuff. And as a result, I got to meet this person, which then introduced me to that person and the other person. And then I got to not only meet all of them, but importantly, start developing my own thoughts and opinions about the areas that I was interested in. And, you know, I started coalescing a lot of that into, in my case, because I was interested in startups and entrepreneurship, you know, business ideas. What's the problem? What's the solution? Is it a viable business? And then starting to pitch those things to people that I was getting to meet. So from that perspective, it's not only useful to just like gain experience, it's really useful to just build a personal professional network and to this day I engage with and rely upon the network that I started building back then.
Yeah, that's really insightful. I could not agree more. And I also feel like it can be quite terrifying to start a company and it could help to have that network behind you. Mm-hmm. When you finished residency, that's when you started Nomad, right? Was there a pause? Was there an exploration phase? Was it a natural transition? Did you have any existential fears? Like, should I practice a little bit, or am I going to just jump into this startup and see whatever happens and learn?
Yeah. So this is a great segue, and it follows directly from what I was just saying. So First, I'll say where was I? What was I doing? So I graduated residency on June 20th, 2015. And at that point, all I had in my hand was I'm going to go be a hospitalist at a New York Presbyterian and be on the faculty at Weill Cornell as a half-time employee. And I said, with that other half of my time, what am I going to do? I know I want to do something else. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I want to do something entrepreneurial, but I don't know what it is. And I said, I want to be in New York because I think that's where the real you know, hub of health tech is going to be. Also, personally, I love New York City. I grew up here. So I said, okay, I'm gonna be in New York. And that's all that I had set up. I just kind of put myself out there. I didn't really have a specific plan. So that was June 20th. But thanks to the network that I had been building over time from my residency, the sort of externship type things that I was doing with these startup companies, my business school relationships, I was introduced to who is now my co-founder on July 9th, 2015, 19 wow. days after I finished my residency. And the basis for that introduction was I was working on an idea that I was pitching around to people, and my friend was a mutual acquaintance of both Kevin, Ryan, and myself.
Yep.
And that he said, hey, you should meet each other. And so we met each other, and long story short, we joined forces, and a few weeks later said, let's do this with Nomad. He and some of his other partners, who are now all of our co-founding group, were working on the idea that was eventually to become Nomad. And we all really hit it off. I actually knew the other co-founders because I'd been in medical school with them. So it was like a amazing, again, network thing. And we all believed in the problem, the solution, the people, and we said, let's just do it. And on July 31st, we incorporated the company, and there you go. That was a little over 6 years ago.
Wow. So the things that you had then was an idea or understanding this problem. You had a solution for it. You had people around you who you felt like you could work with and you loved. And then that was enough for you to be like, let's see what happens. Let's take it and run.
Absolutely. Because here's the thing about all this. It's very hard to plan to get to the place where of that moment of creation. It's really Brownian motion, right? You're just bouncing around, you're meeting the right people, talking about ideas, picking up a thought here, an idea there, a person there, a business connection here. And then at some point it just kind of crystallizes. And then you say, wow, this all makes a ton of sense. And you can kind of almost see the future through that crystallized lens. You can say, wow, that I could see how that could work. It may not. In fact, most startups don't work out. But really, you know, as they always say, you want to invest in an A team, even if they have a B idea, not the other way around, not the B team, an A idea. This was an A team. Kevin is a very, very successful serial technology entrepreneur. Two of the other guys were also physicians. We were starting a business in the, you know, sort of medical recruiting space. And so we were customers. And the fifth guy was a former investor at Union Square Ventures and, you know, a computer programmer. So like a perfect group. And we felt like, yep, I think we can try to make something work here. And I had seen plenty of other people and groups and ideas, and, you know, none of them really passed the smell test, but this really was a good confluence of all of them.
Yeah. I feel like the lesson I'm hearing here is for those who are interested in entrepreneurship, try to build a network out. And then once you have like a really exciting idea, try to build a team of people who have experience, who fill the gaps in your knowledge. And if they have an impressive background and they were willing to back you, you probably have a good idea. I guess that probably pressure tests a little bit, and then, you know, de-risk that a little bit.
Yeah, you've got to be, those things are all true, but there's no perfect recipe for success. And
sure,
and, And so the other really important component here is simply being comfortable with the tremendous amount of risk and uncertainty, that ambiguity that comes around, especially those early days. And what's interesting to me is that is something that is so antithetical to almost everybody in the medical field. By definition, medicine is a conservative, it's a conservative environment, and appropriately so, right? Like, we don't want to just like willy-nilly try some new, you know, experimental treatment on somebody. You know, that's why we have randomized control trials, and we say we need to have it proved with multiple, you know, studies, and it's an extremely conservative group. It's also just from like career perspective, extremely safe, right? You know, there's a track.
Yep.
You go, you're a pre-med in college, then you go to medical school, then you do your residency, then you do your fellowship, then you become an attending, and then you become an assistant professor, then you become an associate professor, and then you become a full professor, and then you do, you know, you write for the New England Journal. And it's like, great, I know exactly what I'm doing for the next 50 years of my life, and I'll make a good living. Like, there's no, and you, so people trade upside opportunity for the security. And so it is very, very hard to handle the ambiguity and risk that's necessary in startup land. And so if you're trying to make that crossover, that's one of the most difficult parts of that crossover. And so, but, you know, kind of leaning into that and saying, I don't care. Like, if it doesn't work, then you're more likely to be successful. Now, obviously, you have to do that in the context of your own life. I was in a very perfect position in my life. I had no obligations, right? So I wasn't married, didn't have any children. All I needed to do was to make sure I could eat some food and have a home, and that was it. And by virtue of, you know, being able to practice medicine, even part-time, you're able to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
The rest of it, it doesn't matter. If it completely fails, I will only be better for the experience, and I can pick myself up and either try to do it again, or, you know, I have this amazing quote unquote, it's like ridiculous to call it a backup option, but backup option to be a clinician. So if anything, it's like almost, despite the mindset's hard to shift, but the context is great. You're a clinician, so you'll never really be in a, you know, your base is very high. So if you fall down, you're going to be in a safe space. But the hardest part is the mental model shift.
That is so insightful. When you were, it's amazing how much this like resonates. When you were starting Nomad, were you still working 50% clinically? Were you able to de-risk your career? You know, taking a few little, you know, risk-free treasury bonds in your life with a 50%, you know, clinical to take on the very high risk 50%, you know, startup entrepreneurial piece of your life.
Well, it was more like 150% because I did 100% at the startup and still 50% hospitalist for,
that
I did
also
that
resonates
for a few
with
years.
Me for sure.
Yeah, it was exhausting because I was mostly doing night shifts and so, you know, I'd work a few night shifts a week and then come straight into the office and work on the company. And I was used to it. I was used to doing 30-hour call, and, you know, in the ICU, so like no big deal. I couldn't do it anymore right now, but at that time it was like I said, I had no other obligation. So all it was just, you know, I could pour myself into the work, and the thing that I paid for was in sleep and, you know, comfort and all that. But yeah, I was, you know, from a financial standpoint doing okay. And then also from a, you know, like a work standpoint, I was also very fortunate to be, as I said earlier, with this great group of co-founders who substantially de-risked the opportunity itself. So anyway, that's how the cookie crumbled.
Yeah. That's amazing. Maybe we should take a moment to talk about what Nomad does. Could you give a brief overview of Nomad for our listeners, Alexi?
Of course. Yeah. So the company is Nomad Health, and we're in the healthcare staffing space. And so what that means is that hospitals all across the country often need surge staff to cover surges in demand, much like what's happening lately with the COVID-19 pandemic. And so they rely upon third-party organizations called staffing agencies to help them fill those gaps. 100% of hospitals every year use temporary staff, locum tenens doctors, traveling nurses, et cetera. And the problem with this industry and the problem that we saw was that it's a completely people-powered industry. There's no technology in sight. So it's very inefficient. It's also a very poor experience, which is why the doctors and the group, we had experienced it. I did locums, work, and it was so painful. It took me 10 months to organize a 3-day job because of all the Wow. paperwork and phone calls you had to do. So our product we've brought to the world is a marketplace, a technology-driven marketplace for healthcare, where you eliminate the middleman broker, automate all the back office processes, provide self-service for all of the clinician and client-facing processes. And in so doing, you create a huge degree of efficiency, which then also allows for scalability. Whereas the traditional agencies in this space, don't have any economies of scale, and that's why it's a very fragmented industry. The largest player is a nearly $6 billion company, but only has 12% market share, and it's because there's no economies of scale. By contrast, our thesis was, if you can build a machine that's automated, it can scale infinitely and become a majority market shareholder. And so that's how we approach this market. And that's exactly what we built. And it works exactly like how you think it would. It's a yep. common trope. I mean, think about, Airbnb or Kayak or something like that. It's the same thing, but instead of, renting a house or booking a flight, you're, renting a nurse, or as a nurse, taking gig work. So, that's essentially what we've built and are continuing to build.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Yeah, I love the analogy of you're doing to the travel nursing industry what Kayak.com or Travelocity did to the travel agency industry. Right. And getting rid of these pushy commission-focused recruiters and tedious paperwork and misaligned incentives. And I Nomad's definitely one of my favorite companies out there, and I'm so excited for the work you've been doing. What is also crazy, of course, Lexi, what's also crazy is you did this and then the pandemic happened, right?
Yeah.
And so some stats to share here was that, to emphasize the stakes of the market and the people you serve, there was an Atlantic article just a few weeks ago that pointed out how 12% of healthcare workers have been laid off since February 2020. And a lot of that has to do with elective procedures that were canceled. And then an additional 18% have quit. And that has a lot to do with people being worked to the bone and burnt out and exhausted. And so this staffing marketplace has had whiplashes like no other these last couple of years. The work that needs to be done is so important. I think of it like providing the soldiers on the front line of the war and being in that business. My question is for you is that what has it been like growing during such a tumultuous economic period and time with the pandemic? How has it been being a leader, answering to your stakeholders, to your nurses, to your employees? And do you get any sleep?
It's been both incredibly challenging and incredibly rewarding. I'll start with the rewarding part. The rewarding part is that we are getting the opportunity to actually be part of the solution, right? We are actually helping to get clinicians to the bedside where they're needed. As I'm sure you've read, you've also mentioned some of the key stats, but especially in the nursing world, which is where we primarily focus, there has been such a shortage of clinicians. It's a real crisis. And so being able to actually source and staff clinicians to wherever they need to go has been tremendously rewarding. In that context, it makes it a lot easier to deal with the incredible amount of challenges. Growing our business as fast as we've grown is hard no matter what, even if it's for a good reason. We've more than doubled the size of our headcount. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think we're about 15 times larger in terms of transactions and volume since the beginning of the pandemic. It is it is an unreal amount of growth in such a short amount of time. It brings to mind the almost the literal terminology of breakneck. I mean, you're going that fast that your head is like, you know, snap backwards and like you could break your neck. So it is, it's extremely, extremely challenging. However, in the context of how rewarding it is, it makes the challenge feel minor. You know, I think there have been many phases of this too. I mean, there's been a lot of ups and downs. It hasn't been, you know, pure growth. It's been, you know, if you rewind the tape all the way back to the, you know, not the very first 2 or 3 months of the pandemic, but the 4th, 5th, 6th months of the pandemic, when all of a sudden the entire world basically just shut down, healthcare world kind of shut down. Nobody was going to hospitals. Literally people were afraid to go to see their doctor or to the hospital. I saw a Jack article that said that there was a 38% reduction in STEMI and stroke presentations to EDs across the nation, which are obviously non-voluntary care, but people were saying, you know what, I'm just not going to go. So in that world, healthcare systems across the country not only didn't need temporary staff, they didn't even need their own staff. They furloughed much of their permanent staff or laid them off. It was a very fallow period for our business, a scary period to be sure. And so, you know, here we are months and years later and, you know, having grown a great business, but there were, you know, death-defying moments too. And so it has been a, it's not only the rate of growth, it's also the rate of change, or the you know, going on both sides of the origin, you know, like it's positive and negative. And so it has really tested our company. It's tested us as individuals. It's tested us as a leadership team. But I'd like to think we passed all of those tests and you know, I'm looking forward to where we can take things from here.
Yeah. And I think that's a testament of you being a real leader and a CEO to pull Nomad through those different phases.
Well, I'll be very quick to say though, it's not just me. I mean, like I you know, in a lot of ways I'm the CEO of the company. So I do a lot of the external, you know, I'm the target, a lot of the external, conversation, but, yeah. And judgment, but honestly, like there's no way I could have done this without every single person in our company. And that's been the most exciting part of this whole thing is like how galvanizing this whole experience has been. And you talked about sending people to war. I mean, it's an apt analogy, although an unfortunate one in a healthcare context. Yeah. But much like war galvanizes troops, when you're in the foxhole together, you know, you really build the bond. And I feel that way with the people that I work with, every single person in our company. And so it truly is a team effort. And I get to talk about it, but really I'm just representing a group of people.
Do you think being a physician made you better prepared to communicate and navigate through that uncertainty and risk?
You know, that's actually an interesting question. I haven't thought about it that way, but I do think so because I almost immediately go right to the thought of having to share bad news when you're a clinician, right? So when you're a doctor, you're specifically trained. I can even recall where and how I learned the, you know, how to deliver bad news thing. When you have to share difficult news or when you don't know the answer, there is a good way and a bad way to do that. Or there is a good way and there are many bad ways to do it. And I think, you know, knowing that you have to be very direct, that you have to be very transparent. You don't want to beat around the bush. All of those things, I think, really did help get through the highs and the lows. There are plenty of times during this whole thing where I just didn't know what was going to happen. And I think taking that sort of like being humbled by the experience, being humbled by the environment in which you are and not being hard-headed like you, like the sort of prototypical or stereotypical, you know, CEO, whereas I know we need to do, I know where we need to go, I know how we need to do it. And just follow me. There's nothing, there's no problem. There's no crack in the armor. We're going like that. I don't think is a very functional, a very functional leadership style in the middle of any crisis, much less like a once in a century crisis. Yeah. But in medicine, you have no control over what's happening. You are just responding to the environment as it is around you. Cancer came, the virus came, you know, heart attack came. You can't do anything about it except to be very honest about this is the situation. This is what we can do. This is what we know. This is what we don't know. And so I think that attitude, which I didn't consciously think about, but I guess had developed through my medical life, was, I think, hopefully helpful.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think there are certain, I don't know, as I've been reflecting on this, I think there are certain strengths that you get as a leader from your medical training, but I don't know if it's always understood or if it applies to every situation. I definitely can't imagine a more apt situation than, you know, leading people across stakeholders through this pandemic, like you were discussing. Do you feel
No. Go ahead. I'll say my thought in a moment.
Yeah, I was wondering do you think that any of the habits that physicians develop with interpersonal communication might also conflict with the demands of a CEO? That's a question I've been trying to ask myself too, to try to identify where my blind spots might be. I was wondering if you might have discovered anything there.
Yeah, and this sort of relates to the thing that I interrupted you to say. We're obviously in the same headspace now. I mean, there are plenty of things that medical training doesn't teach you to do or teaches you to do poorly. And actually, I think, uh-huh. You know, people management is one of those things. I don't think medicine is a particularly great field in the world for people management. I obviously there are exceptions, but I don't think that is like one of the hallmarks of medical education is teaching you how to lead, how to manage. I do think increasingly there is an emphasis on teamwork. But it is still, I don't think, the most prevalent sense of how to operate in an environment. I think perhaps one of the blind spots that you're trying to elicit is that in many ways, I think physicians still kind of think of themselves as, like the ultimate leader, sort of like their knowledge is above and therefore unquestionable. And that hubris, I think, can get in the way. And I don't mean to, paint with a broad brush and you know, I don't think a lot of doctors are like this, but it is the stereotype. And we have made a lot of progress away from that over the last several decades, but, unwillingness to participate in a cross-functional team and understand the limits of your knowledge, I think are some of the blind spots that some physicians can have some of the time. So, certainly something to be aware of from a sort of a mental model point of view.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Robert Pearl, who is the former CEO of Kaiser Permanente Medical Group, wrote a book. I interviewed him earlier in the summer around this exact issue, around the paternalism of physician culture and how that's permeated in a lot of the ways that our healthcare system is sort of a little bit rigid. That's a really valuable insight. And I've got so many other questions, but I think I want to pause for time because I want to get to my last question that I ask everybody, and I find it fun to see how people respond to this. And this has been so much fun. Like I say, I can't thank you enough for this conversation. So the last question is there anything you came across recently that you found compelling or interesting that you might recommend for our listeners, which could be a book, an article, TV show, a song, movie, another podcast? We even had somebody recommend a tricycle. So
I'm constantly, reading and trying new things. And so I'll take it away from work or sort of professional life. And
yeah.
I read a really fun book. And I think it's actually important to just kind of check out sometimes and, you know, activate a different part of your mind. I read this really great compendium of short stories by the author Simon Rich, who is a, he writes for The New Yorker, often in that Shouts and Murmurs section. I think he's written for SNL and for The Simpsons, I think. So he's a humorist. This book is called New Teeth. And it's a whole bunch of short stories about childhood and parenting. And I'm a relatively new dad. I have a 14-month-old son, almost 14-month-old son. And so a lot of the stuff rang true. And even if you don't have children, it's just so funny. So I really enjoyed reading that. I think it came out a few weeks ago. I read it and it just zipped right through it. So recommend it to anybody.
I love that. New Teeth by Simon Rich. Well, Lexi, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. This was really great. I really I'm honored to be invited, and I wish you good luck as well.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked, or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.